Hello, folks. It's me, Justin Robert Young. You're going to hear me on the podcast. I'm going to be talking, making some jokes. But right now, I've got some business to take care of. How about this? Three pieces of news. Again, Andrew Mayne's Don't Trust Andrew Mayne airs on A&E this Monday at 11 p.m. Boom. Two episodes. Also, huge news! Brian's getting a TV show, too. Hacking the System with Brian Brushwood will air on the National Geographic Channel. More details to come on that. And we got a new place for you to live stream not only weird things, but a bunch of fun content. Head over to diamondclub.tv and see what we're working on. Meh, enough of that. Let's get to the show. Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Mayne, joined by Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Remote on location, sir, reporting to duty.
Looks like he's using his Radio Shack microphone.
It totally is. It's just better enough than the laptop mic that that I'm totally rocking it. And I look like Bob Costas with a dripping eye infection.
And speaking of dripping eye infections, Mr. Justin Robert Young.
The internet's dripping eye infection. That's the reputation that I've been building up for the last several years. Bob Costas and his eye infection, also Syracuse students, but not graduates.
I've only seen all this stuff peripherally, like on Twitter and stuff. Like, did he have like a horrific eye sore or something?
He had some pink eye. He had pink eye in one eye, and then the pink eye spread to the other eye.
Did he wear a man? I'd wear a patch so fast. If you just make a comment about the color of my eyes, I'll put on an eye patch for you.
What, you mean your weird colored eyes that you have now?
Crap! Come on! BRB!
Gentlemen, I want to jump right in.
Yeah, jump. Let's go.
We have a woman. We'll call her Miss K.
Okay.
Miss K was forced to leave her apartment. Why?
Well, I mean, she's a deadbeat, obviously. She wasn't paying her rent. She was having parties at all hours. We can't afford all that, so we kicked her out.
Just because it's the Weird Things podcast, I'm going to assume that it is something that she was keeping that was inappropriate for her residence.
Let's say that the forcing of out of her apartment may be more of her own choice.
Oh. Was it haunted? Was she living in a haunted apartment?
That I do not know.
Was it? Oh, is it like the Tenant, the movie The Tenant? Were they just driving everybody crazy so they would try to commit suicide? Spoiler alert.
Instantly looks up The Tenant on Netflix. Okay, so you're telling me it's totally not sound related? I mean, I was making a joke about having parties at all hours, but if it's
It wasn't like the cops knocked on her door and said, you got to leave.
Wait, it was or
no,
was not?
It was not. It was not like authorities said, you have to leave. She's like, I got to get out of here.
Oh, man. And I'm assuming from the whole, like, got to get out of here, that's not usually the thing you say because you found the perfect apartment or because you bought a house. So it's not that there's something better that she's going to. Man, I'm still stuck on the noise thing.
Is it one of those things where there's like a billion different snakes? Remember we had the snake house?
Yeah.
Is it snake house?
It's not snakes.
I'm going to say
it's got to be roaches or mice or something disgusting.
I'm going to go if I'm going to pick a critter and I don't know if I'm picking this out of the blue or because maybe I heard a random like Google news story about it, but for some reason I want to say bats. Is it bats?
Well, first let's touch on what Justin said. It's got to be something disgusting. I think if it was a bunch of cute and cuddly animals, she wouldn't be leaving.
No, you know? She would have the next BuzzFeed right there. Just, you know, like you have your own little cottage industry, lady.
And answer to that,
reasons why it's awesome to live with these cats.
Yeah. Brian hit it right on the head.
Whoa, bats. Did I really?
Yep, that's it. So this woman, all of a sudden, there were hundreds of bats that apparently were living on the outside, and then they decided, you know what? I think we want to go on the inside. Several hundred bats moved inside of her apartment.
Okay, can I tell you real quick, Austin is
famous.
Yeah, Austin's a little bit famous for the bats, okay? The Congress Street Bridge in Austin, right above the what was Town Lake and now called Lady Bird Lake, has like 1.5 million bats living in there. You can smell the guano as you drive over it, and certainly as you jog or run over it. When I 20 years ago, I went to the University of Texas and stayed at this dorm that had Andrew's dorm that had a little pavilion that was outside, and there's those terracotta shingles, you know, those clay shingles all over. And there was a time I just everything worked out right. I walked out. It was maybe 2 or 3 in the morning, and you know how shortly before it rains, everything feels like charged. You know, you could kind of smell it in the air that it's coming. I walked out and was hanging out there, and just looking at all of the bats. The whole sky was alive with blurs of bats going this way and that way, and then it started to rain just a little bit. Just enough to where like, oh, well, pretty soon I should bother to go back in. But in this moment, like the bats figured out like, oh, it's about to get bad. And all the bats came and understand this pavilion is such where it's like you put your hand on the handrails going all the way around it. The handrails are about 3 feet of shingles going out in front of you. So it's like you place your hands on the shingles or whatever. And hundreds of bats all come and land on all these shingles right in front of me. And right in front of me, maybe 18 inches, one of them lands, and you get a good look, and you realize how much like mice they are, and it starts walking on all fours with its legs and its bat arms, and it just sort of squeezes itself underneath the terracotta shingle, and that's what's happening all around me, and all of a sudden I realize that there are hundreds of bats living in this area right where everyone goes out to smoke and hang out every day. It was one of those astonishing moments that I'm sure if you're a batologist, number one, screw you for knowing so much about bats. But I'm sure all this is old news. But to me, viscerally, to see that happen in front of you and to just know that all the time the bats are right there was amazing. It was an electric experience.
Watching, judging.
So like you didn't become like a superhero or nothing? Like this seems like something that you would use as a turning point so you could become a caped Avenger.
Well, see, the problem was like Bruce Wayne was genuinely traumatized. I was like mildly discomfited. So I compensated, but it's like I don't fight crime and dress as a bat. I sort of give to charity and think bats are all right.
That's a pretty so it's good like it's thing.
The reversal was you know in keeping with the amount of discomfort.
And then your father came to you on the patio and said, "Why do we take smoke breaks, Brian? Because we need to learn to get back up."
So, on the animal subject, a zoo in Denmark is having a little bit of a public relations problem.
Oh, I heard about this.
I don't know anything about this.
All right, this is good then. So, Brian, They put on a display, a well-attended display, and I want you to try to guess what this display was.
For some reason, this makes it so much better.
A very strong international reaction to the display that they put on.
Okay.
It was very strong.
A one-time event, although there are rumors there may be another zoo there may do the same thing.
Wait, okay. So whatever it is, it's something that wasn't so bad that another zoo wouldn't consider doing it as well.
The other zoo decided they probably will not do it. There was rumors like, oh, we might do this too, and now they're like, no plans to do this.
Oh my God. All right. Well, let's get a sense of it. Obviously involves animals, I assume, right?
Safe to say.
Are we talking about big critters or small critters? Like bigger than my fist, smaller than my fist?
Bigger than your fist, Brian.
All right.
These are A-listers.
Okay. All right. So we're probably talking like a big game, like a panda or a cougar or a lion or a bear. I'm trying to think of which of these. Okay. There's only one of these animals that is emotionally charged, and it feels panda-like to me. Are we talking about pandas?
No.
We are not. This is not about a panda cam. This is not panda-related in any way.
Huh. All right. And so when you say public display...
Event. It was an event.
It was a one-time-only event.
I mean, did something eat something else? That's what it seems to me I would expect.
That was not what the event was about.
Oh, shoot. That was very carefully phrased, Andrew. which makes me think that it wasn't necessarily how it's supposed to go down. I mean, what would you – I'm trying to think of what kind of PR events zoos need to have. I mean, would you publicly show animals mating?
Well, I think they do.
That happens all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's safe to say that this is a zoo that has fallen under just criticism.
If your PR strategist suggested this idea to you, you'd probably be better off firing them.
Yeah, that is grounds for immediate dismissal. Like, just bringing that up in the office, you are justifiably fired immediately by anybody with half a shred of common sense.
So how did this go through? Whatever the idea is, it must have had some kind of spin that makes sense. Wait, it wouldn't be like a petting zoo turned awry where it ate kids or something.
No,
this was planned.
Planned. Okay. And when you say an event, like, I'm trying to think, like, what are the things that animals do? They eat, they poop, and they have sex. And I'm trying to think which of those three things you would want to put on display. And we already, you guys blew off sex because they do that all the time. The eating, okay, so a feeding of something. Okay, what about this? All right. So if you do a feeding of some animal and you expect it to eat what you lay out for it, but instead it ate each. Are there two different breeds involved? Or
no,
just one?
One animal, and I'll clarify it for you. Everything happened exactly as they planned it to.
Yeah.
This thing
what?
Happened. They said, we'll do this. This is what's going to happen, and it all happened according to plan.
I thought it was two different animals, though.
Well, I asked breeds or species.
Oh, breeds,
or whatever.
Okay.
So, okay. Huh. Well, all right. The mere fact that there's some kind of confusion about...
No, well, there's the event.
No.
That's what happened after is what Justin's talking about that was also part of the plan. But there's the event that they say, hey, everybody, come to this event.
Yeah.
All right.
The one animal.
Let me try to zero in on the animal. That may help me. So you said no pandas. It's a predator? Like a meat-eating predator?
No, it is not.
No.
Whoa. All right. Is it so it's an herbivore, I assume?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like a giraffe?
Exactly.
Yep.
Whoa! By the way, right now, wearing my Last of Us t-shirt, complete with a giraffe on it. Man, okay, where's this going? This is somehow more entertaining for me, knowing that both you and Justin know what's going on. It did involve eating, though. It was a feeding?
No, not this event. There was something related to that, but that was not the intent of this particular – what happened at this event.
Oh, my God. I think I know what it was. All of a sudden, this also, like a ghost whisper on the Google News, like a headline that I half read last week. Did they put down a giraffe for some reason?
Exactly.
Do your best to sell me on the idea before you explain to me how hilariously perverse the reaction was.
Well, here's the reasoning, and I listened to actually a really interesting explanation of why they did it from the director of Zoo Miami. He's a regular guest on the Dan Le Batard show, which is a sports show, but he does a weekly segment where people just ask him any animal questions. They were talking about this story, and from what he was saying, the issue is that the giraffe was not the right bloodline. And so this is something that happens in captivity all the time, where it was not going to help the herd
They breed these giraffes. They have a gene pool, and they want to avoid putting these too many giraffes of the similar genetics into the same gene pool. And so you're afraid if one giraffe breeds with the other ones when you have another one, you want that to do the breeding.
So now this does happen a lot, but you very often – you know that they are of the wrong gene pool when they're born. So normally they're either put down or sent to another zoo kind of immediately that can make use of it. This zoo instead allowed it to live and gave it a name, which are apparently not great protocols, and then ignored other zoos once they made this plan public the other zoos said, no, we'll take it. We'll take the animal. We'll take the giraffe. And they ignored it. In favor of what, Andrew?
In favor of what they decided to do is they turn it into a public event in which they invited children to watch as the giraffe was put down, and then they dissected the giraffe. And there's a wonderful photo you can find on IO9 of them pulling a big, huge chunk of rib meat or something out of a giraffe with the children watch on. So they put down the giraffe, dissected in front of kids, and then fed the giraffe to the lions.
Oh my God! This is okay. This is like some kind of, this is like a grand prix of bad decisions. Like somehow they nailed every single wrong turn they could make. Are you kidding me?
So here's how I like to imagine the pitch process went, Brian. Justin and I walk inside. Justin's got a boombox. I'm like, all right, you ready for this? You're like, okay, guys. I press play, and you hear Elton John start singing Circle of Life. Like, Brian, nature's a circle. It's not a beginning and end. It's a circle. And you know, Marius the giraffe, I think he bit a child the other day.
Marius, right? That was his name?
Marius is the giraffe. I think he bit a child. It didn't get caught on security cameras, but I'm pretty sure he bit a child.
Oh.
This is like Blackfish, but like legitimate.
Yeah, long neck like, or something. Yeah.
Oh my God. So everybody gets fired, right? Like this is like the janitors have to be fired for this. Like everyone's gotta go.
So there was another zoo that was rumored to have the same problem. They thought, well, maybe we do this. And then they're like, oh, no, we're not going to. And the zoo's like, hey, we're glad. We're proud of it. We did this. And I once heard it said that, you know, Europeans excel at two things, coffee and genocide. Now let's add giraffeicide.
So where did this take place?
Denmark.
Okay. Wow. And so it was a case where, like, in Denmark, is everybody cool with this? They're like, yeah, that's what we do with giraffes.
No, there are protests. I mean, there are some people cool with it, but a lot of people protest. My inappropriate comment before aside, I mean, yeah, Europeans and very much people were very upset with it, and some people were pro and et cetera, and it's...
I mean, listen, if you're Denmark, there's only so many things you're known for. Is this really? You want to add that to the list of international things? Welcome to Denmark. We murk giraffes in front of kids. That's just the way we roll.
All right. Now, let me play giraffe killer's advocate here.
Okay.
and just say to put it in context, because I'm with you guys. This is... if nothing else, a horrifically bad assessment of what will go over well in the public eye. But for everybody who is genuinely riled up and crazy, I don't know. I'm reading a lot of biology books recently, and it just has me in a weird state where I'm like, what's so special about giraffes? Like, why is it totally okay to kill so many cows and cut them up and eat them, but cutting up a giraffe that's on a dead-end track.
I absolutely hear you, Brian. I absolutely hear you on this. I think that it's the idea of the zoo should sort of be this safe place for the special animals, not the ones that were like, cows, whatever, but like the idea that a zoo, you know, which we tolerate the idea of zoos because we think like, hey, they allow us access to these animals rather than, you know, going out in their place. They preserve animals. It's a place to make animals special. It's like when you find out that, like, you know, how many animal kill shelters are actually run by, like, people who want to save animals.
Yeah. Well, and actually, that's legitimate. Like, horrifically, you know, PETA, of course, works very hard to carve themselves out a reputation for trying to save animals. But so often they'll come in, and when they save animals, they're like, yes, we have all these animals. They're in terrible situations. The only thing to do is to kill them. And like they kill tons of animals.
And I don't know what the better solution is. And this is a situation here where like, but here it seemed like there were other options of like, you know, why don't, you know, we could give it somewhere else, but no, we're gonna murder the giraffe in front of children.
Well, I guess that's because really the gasoline that has this go from something for which would be a 50 reply thread on the zookeeper's bulletin board, message board, right? Like, it goes from that to an international news is the kids. That you're bringing the kids in and you're saying you need to see this because this is an important lesson about life, for which it really is. Every single one of those kids will have left watching that display and understanding this is what it looks like to be really, really dumb and incompetent at your job. Is this is a plan gone so far awry that you are now a mockery the world over.
The circle of life.
And what's funny is I want to break it down like a circle of life and like, and now it is the zookeeper's job to slaughter the giraffe and to hand it to the lion. And in that regard, the zookeeper does its job in the circle of life.
Oh, my God. Imagine. I mean, listen, I didn't see this thing, but if Disney did do this, like, oh, can you imagine the polish on that presentation?
Morgan Freeman narrating.
Oh, God, definitely.
The entire giraffe is handed out to the lions. Not one scrap is lost.
You know, the drums, the big booming drums when the lions come out after they dissect it.
I think that the point that I think that was made earlier by Justin, was it Ron McGill who made that? Or
Ron McGill, yeah.
Yeah. Is that it's not like the zoo should have been surprised by the giraffe's genetics. Like, oh, hey, guess what? Apparently he has genes and they do not, you know, match up with our program here. You know, that's...
No, this is, I mean...
A little dodgy.
You know what it is, and you can give it away. I mean, like, leading up to it, like, this was purposeful. Like, they knew what the criticism was before it happened. They knew that there were outs for it, and they did not take them because they felt it was a very important lesson for the kids to learn about. The kids, Brian and Andrew.
The children. Think about the children. All right, gentlemen, do you want another animal story, or do we want to go into technology?
I'm feeling like it's time to flip a switch, I think.
Tech?
Yeah, let's go.
So there was a I'm trying to remember the original source, but I found the Kurzweil AI article about this, and it actually comes from October of 2011. And I think it was probably IO9 or Gizmodo or something like there that started. I found the first link to it. Anyways, followed through. And what this was is... We've talked about this a lot, about aliens and why haven't we found them out there and the reasons we may or may not be able to find them and just the multitude explanations. And we've talked about there's the idea of the Fermi paradox, where Enrico Fermi had suggested that if we were going to find aliens, we would have found them by now, their intelligent life out there, because they would have expanded and expanded to the point that there would be tire tracks on the moon, et cetera, what have you. And the evidence of them isn't there, so therefore it seems likely that they're not there. And there's a lot of problems with the Fermi paradox, many of them. It assumes, one, that intelligent species would want to expand. We talked about this last week with Tom Merritt. And something, whenever this discussion comes up, we bring up is the idea that we don't know, you know, what would technology look like 500 years from now or 1,000 years from now? And our vacuum tubes are just over 100 years old. and trying to explain, you know, how an iPad works to somebody 120 years ago. You could say, like, there's electricity and there's this, trying to explain cloud computing. You know, I can't explain it right now.
Well, so, you know the way that I think of it, Andrew, is sort of like it kind of doesn't matter. If we want ourselves to be known to aliens, it kind of doesn't matter. Everything we did up until the invention of the radio kind of doesn't count because nothing was loud enough to get off planet that sounded like a signal. And then for about 200 years, we made analog signals. But weirdly, like right now, we're all switching to digital and encrypted signals. So essentially, we're going quiet again. So well, this makes me – oh, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And this takes us into a whole nother level, whole nother step in talking about like – the kind of, because like we see that progression, as you just pointed out, from this technology of analog that's loud and noisy to digital and discrete into the line of sight, et cetera. There's a research paper by Hugo de Garis, who is originally, I believe he was a computer professor of computer science, and then started talking about getting into the idea of saying, where do we go next? Where do we go next after these things? And we've heard discussions of like, you talk about like, you take computers and then you get them, when you want to get them as small as you can, as we understand, we talk about nanotech, you know, building logic gates out of individual atoms. You know, for computation, you need basically an OR gate, an AND gate, or a NOND gate, you know, which basically says, if this, do this, if this, do that. That's every computer is basically reduced to that. With that, you can describe anything else. What we're trying to do now, either with, you know, quantum mechanics, and we're trying to create computers that use quantum events, we're trying to reduce the size of these things so they're so much smaller. So a nanotech computer, you know, something the size of a sugar cube, you know, would be more powerful than all the computers combined ever times like 1,000 more.
And
I'll wait for Brian.
All right, but the audio listeners don't know that Brian.
No, I'm sorry. The phone rang.
No, totally and... cool. Totally cool.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, no worries. No worries, all that. I apologize for pause. I just wanted you to participate. I mean, I wanted to get your
opinion. Crazy expectation, Andrew. Come on. It's only a podcast with all three of us. You expect all three of us to pay attention?
No. It's totally cool. Totally. Justin was upset with me that I was
I wasn't upset.
It's like for the audio
bring me up to speed on the 10 seconds I missed.
So basically, we've talked about like nanotech is the idea of trying to build computers as small as you can, you know, sugar cube size things that would be massive supercomputers more powerfully we can imagine. And we talk about the upper limits. And so this guy gets into saying, okay, beyond that, there's what they talk about picotech, which is getting into sort of the particles that make up, you know, matter and trying to mess around with those. And he says, let's take that even further. And he has a description of what he calls femtotech. And understand, every time you go to this smaller layer, you get thousands of more times faster, thousands of times smaller, whatever, exponentially smaller, exponentially whatever. You know, a vacuum tube, which started off as something that was the size of the first ones were the size of basically your fist or, you know, you could never build, you know, a really powerful computer out of those because it would take forever to do computations, et cetera, and the amount of heat it would produce is ridiculous. When you had the transistor, which is something the size of the tip of a pencil eraser, you know, that reduced the size of computers considerably. When somebody came up with the idea of putting silicon on a chip in the computer, the integrated circuit, all of a sudden scales get reduced massively. You're talking millions or billions of transistors on a chip.
Well, and it's not just the size that gets reduced, but it's also the energy requirements, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The smaller it is, and the less distance to travel, the more you could get done with less energy.
So he gets into the idea of if we take that down, he thought about what can you do if you went below the level of atoms? What kind of computation could you do if you started to interact with things? And he was decided to go read up on quantum chromodynamics, which gets into basically the way that when we start talking about elementary particles like quarks, etc., is to say, okay, you know, quarks and gluons, they have what they call, you know, basically like color or charm to them or whatever however it's described. And then could you fundamentally use quarks and gluons, which are the things that make up the things, and they are, you know, you ever look at like, you know, when they describe how small is the nucleus of an actual atom, you know, when you look at that. And it's like, imagine, you know, a football in the middle of, you know, the solar system or something. So if you can condense it.
Let me chime in on this with something that, number one, this is amazing because it shatters what I had previously thought was the most mind-blowing small information technology I could wrap my mind around. And so to give you a context, give me just a minute to explain. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. I read all three of Richard Feynman's books. I think one was a collection of his speeches. Mm-hmm. If you haven't read it, Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, and What Do You Care What Other People Think are amazing. And there's one of those might be the name of the collection of his speeches he gave. And he gave a speech talking to a bunch of engineers in which he just rattled off a bunch of crazy ideas about what might be possible with computing at the micro scale. And there were two ideas that really stuck with me. One was a way of, he was wondering what is the densest amount of information you could possibly get. And he theorized, atom by atom, he said, look, technology aside, let's picture an arrangement, a flat arrangement of atoms where you can actually pluck out individual atoms and you can, like a grid, use atoms as pixels and you can draw, you know, it takes a figure of about 20 pixels to draw a single character, like the letter B or whatever. And he said, how small could you make the Encyclopedia Britannica? And he posed the entire thing not as the way we think of storing information as, you know, electronic states of on and off or whatever, but almost as a ultra microscopic engraving of a tablet of the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. And he was able to work up some math on exactly how small it could be. And he also talked about the problems with computing, and you probably know more about this than me, Andrew, but there's like a certain voltage below which current doesn't always go the same direction. Is that right? Where it's like the one of the things we deal with our circuits is that they heat up because we're essentially overpowering them, but we have to overpower them because below a certain threshold, we get errors because the current can flow backwards. And I know we have Tensor Guy in the chat who probably is screaming that I'm getting all this wrong. But he suggested, could we design a circuit with a set of gates that worked two ways, where all of a sudden you were able to solve problems with current that would flow both directions. It would sort of ebb forward, but it would periodically sift back. Then all of a sudden, with virtually no energy, you're able to accomplish great things. Anyway, that to me was the previous record holder of amazing, mind-blowing computational theory at the micro scale. But now you just blew that away, sir.
So when you start talking about femtotech and you take the idea of going into like, you know, you have the atom, which would be nanoscale. And then when you start to go smaller and you talk about the nucleus, you're something like 100,000 times smaller. Okay. So you go from like, you know, you at the picometer, you're 10 to the negative 12. And then, you know, atoms like 10 to the negative 10. And then when you go to femtotech, you're talking 10 to the negative 25. And he describes a way in which you can take these very tiny, infinitesimally small particles that aren't even technically particles we understand because they're what make up matter, and use them to interact and try to create computational systems out of it. Now, granted, there's so many we don't know, but he's explaining like, listen, there's a process by which you could make computation happen if you could figure out some mechanicals, you know, the physically how to make it work. But there's a process going on in the universe that you could allow for computation to occur. When you start talking about creating computers out of that, you start talking about, you know, building massive computational systems inside of individual atoms, right? Every computer we've ever known, ever built, whatever could fit inside of a single atom. Mind blowing, right?
Yeah. Now, and so okay, if you have how do they address anything like as I understand it, things get a wee bit nutty at the subatomic level.
Sure. And it starts getting into trying to understand basically looking at when you look at super collider interactions and looking at what happens when this particle meets this particle, what happens, what do they do, et cetera. But the idea is to take what we know, how these things interact and say, could you do computation based on that?
But by the way, I love the idea of a wee bit nutty as the explanation. Like there's going to be a zoom in and there's just oversized mallets and seltzer water and, you know, squirting flowers.
So all I'm going to say is this, is that already we have, if you had this level of technology, which, you know, Ray Kurzweil, who's certainly into thinking, you know, way outside of the box, talks about the idea that we'd be into doing pico, you know, computing in the next century. Okay. And one of the things, the idea is starting into pico computing and perhaps femto computing, the idea that you start reducing these computational systems to extremely small. The article closes by the author talking about his next thing he's been thinking about is the concept of atotech, which is basically getting into computation using weak force particles, W and Z particles that, you know, that interact down with quarks, but with much lighter leptons, et cetera, and getting into, and that's a scale of 10 to the negative 18, okay, or 10 to the power, okay? What that means is you're talking about an entire universe in an atom of computation, okay? So if you had this technology to do that, you're not going to see alien civilizations spreading across the galaxy. They're going to get progressively smaller and smaller and smaller. And each time they reach this new level, the amount of space they have to play with through computation increases just on a humongous scale.
Man. So what would – let's talk about what a future would be. Let's say everything, all of that across the board, true. Like at that point – I mean, you make the brain look stupid. Like our brains, the most wondrous creation in the universe, so according to so many, the combinations of which outnumber the number of molecules in the complete universe, all of a sudden is just a dumb, clunky, worse than vacuum tube kludge.
Yeah, I mean, when you start getting to this, the idea of what this sort of computing power gives you, you reach this ability, the capability of you know, nearly infinite, yet not taking up much space or whatever. And the idea that, you know, that there's a shortage of intelligent agents to sort of use that space, unless what you start doing is just creating more and more and more worlds within worlds filled with super AIs that are doing whatever they want.
So I forgive me if this is a departure here, but as long as we're already like all bets are off, universe is crazy. When people talk about the likelihood of our universe being a hologram, what do they mean by that? Is hologram like a euphemism for a cognitive illusion or a simulation run in some cosmic computer? Or when they call the universe a hologram or say it might be a hologram, does that imply like all of this third dimension is only an artifact of what we think is there? Or fourth dimension or fifth dimension?
I'm going to go with the latter. I think it kind of is the idea that when we think about our constructs of time and space and volume and things like this, these are things that are kind of just, in a sense, almost artificial constructs that we create in ways to understand how things work. You know, when you start looking at quantum interactions and things, when we're, you know, exist, you know, operating from afar, et cetera, like that, the way things are connected, you know, exist in ways that just don't fit into regular three-dimensional way of looking at things.
So when they say hologram, do they mean like this is like the third dimension is simulated, or do they mean the fourth dimension, which could be time or whatever, you know, whatever idea you want to substitute for it?
I think all of it. I think the way all of it sort of gets spaced out into that. I'm really not smart enough to have an intelligent answer on that, so I'm only going to give you my.
All right, that's fine. As to be honest, I'm comfortable
allow
as long
me
as
to step in, Andrew.
I mean, to be honest, I'm comfortable as long as all three of us are equally dumb on the subject. I just wanted to, if there was a perspective that I hadn't seen, I would love to hear it.
I mean, the way that I sort of try to look at it is, you know, what's probably the most advanced video game right now?
I don't know. Let's just say whatever, latest Call of Duty. Fine.
So you got Call of Duty. You got your character.
Or Battlefield. I think Battlefield is the latest hotness.
Got Battlefield. So you have a character in Battlefield, or you have some of your enemies in Battlefield, and they have a certain amount of limited artificial intelligence that goes into these, you know, agents, right?
Sure.
You know, they respond to their environment, they respond to you, they evolve, they do whatever.
And they
seek
cover, and they plank and all that stuff.
And we see emergent behavior in these games now, too, where you see your antagonists behave in ways that were not programmed into them. They learn and they respond to ways that are smarter than a paramecium would in some ways, okay? And that can be unsettling. When they started doing some of the first big computer modeling systems for things like, you know, Lord of the Rings, and they'd have like 100,000 orcs on a battlefield, and then they would have something interact with them, and they watched them respond in their own way, their own flocking behavior, their own way to get out of the way. It's chilling because you're like, holy crap, I didn't program that. They just figured out what to do. So you take an advanced form of that AI that where it can answer questions, things like that, maybe ask questions if he's real, et cetera, and he's running around battlefield. And you ask him, what is the universe really like? And he can say, well, there's space, there's dimension, there's this, I can pick up this rock, I can pick up all that. All that's wrong. All that's wrong. It's on a flat microchip, you know? Everything is just this timed way in which these things interact or whatever, but it creates the illusion for the actor inside of there that there's space, there's all of this. But the reality is that it's that structure and all these things we see to it aren't the way it is at all.
So here's a question that gets a little bit deeper than we normally delve into in the Weird Things podcast. But let's say the simulations are in and the math works out and everyone decides, yes, all of reality is definitely an illusion. We are a simulation that's being run on a mega microchip of unbelievable size and scope. We peeked outside our petri dish, and we are but a figment of the imagination of a computer simulation somewhere. What do you think that does? And this is a gate where traditional religion would have to make a decision, because it's an end game by which traditional religion, and I mean all religions, could either say, aha, we were right. We knew it wasn't just this dirt and rock and science and random collisions. We have a purpose to our life. And what we were calling God is the creator of this machine that runs us. Or do they reject everything out of hand, saying that's even kookier science nonsense? It's all just the dirt and rock and so on.
I think that part of the answer has been in the fact that there may be an agreement about the idea of a prime mover among religions, yet we have hundreds of thousands of religions that say, well, yeah, that's a given. The more important thing is the structure and the way he wants us to live our lives. And the idea that I don't think, you know, that we found out that we're inside of a petri dish would solve any of those arguments or disagreements whatsoever. And I don't even know, but I think they would think that, like, yeah, but we think there's something outside of there. And, you know, the resistance you have from some people to even simple things like, you know, evolution or ideas that say that, listen, there's this faceless driving force towards us and, you know, is a super intelligent AI that makes us any more decipherable. And I mean, the theory I like is, like, what if we found out that we were actually all living inside of a simulation in a Google computer in like 2017?
That's awesome.
Our creator's Justin.
Yeah. And now I have chosen to reveal myself as your one true overlord.
So it makes me think of, like, what's funny is, like, if that happened and that was that fundamental, mind-blowing, earth-shattering truth were revealed to us, the funny part to me is, like, wow, that's really amazing. Also, I have cord killers tomorrow at 5:30, so I need to get back to show prep.
Exactly. I think that, like, you know, life goes on. You know, like, I look at, like, you know, a roller coaster. I can show you the physics of a roller coaster. I can explain all the details. I can show you, you know, all the little things that go into that, you know, and then say, okay, does that change your experience one bit once I strap you in and send you onto the roller coaster ride? You know, does knowing the velocity, is knowing the curves, knowing the whole layout of the track change the fact that you're screaming and enjoying it or terrified?
Well, and I guess also the way the question was put to me like 5 years ago, my friend Gus Davis asked, like, hey, seriously, let's say we full on got an alien transmission and there's no doubt that we absolutely now know that we're not alone in the universe and these guys were getting TV signals from over. What would that do to society? And my answer was, like, pretty much nothing. Because that's been the truth for all of our fundamental life-changing truths. Like, when the secret of relativity became clear to us, I mean, I guess there was a few practical things. We made a bomb or whatever, you know, and when the secret of when the human genome was finally decoded, you know, we all bought stock in .coms and we just, you know, kind of nothing changes.
I think that I would say that on the surface, nothing changed. I mean, there's the media and then there's, you know, we still go to work. We still do that. But then you think about, like, the nature of the communication could mean a lot. You ever see the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy?
Yes. Yes. For those of you who are younger than 40, like me, the Gods Must Be Crazy was all about an Aboriginal man who discovers a Coke bottle that fell out of the sky and decides it's a religious talisman, an object from the gods, and hijinks ensue from there, right?
Yeah, and so it's here you have this guy. He's one of the San people in Africa, which is arguably probably the oldest living civilization group of people there is. Their lives have not changed considerably in the last 60,000 years.
Long time.
And they're a fascinating
school.
And it's fascinating too, is you look at them and you want to, like, a lot of their features and stuff, you know, they're an early people, but you see things that you would sort of recognize as Caucasian in some respects, because, you know, it was, you know, our ancestors came from that period. You know, I mean, us on the podcast, people listening come from all over, and it's, they're fascinating people. But anyhow, you have this idea of this person who's still living largely in this world, and a Coke bottle falls out of the sky, and a Coke bottle, this clear glass bottle, is this. It's an alien artifact, you know. It's an alien artifact, and he figures this is so priceless and special. He owes it to bring it back to the people who left this, and it's a fascinating story. But you take a look at, like, if we get an alien signal, do we go, man, are these people smarter than us? What can we tell from this signal? And all of a sudden, it changes the idea of what's possible.
Yeah, you know, that's something that, you know, if you ever listen to, I think it may date back to his radio show, but at some point, Penn Jillette was talking about in the juggling world, where there was however, 20, 30 years, nobody could go from, and again, all these facts are wrong, from five-ball juggling to six-ball juggling. But within, like, 2 weeks of the very first video of somebody juggling six balls, all of a sudden, here's two kids doing it. Like, it redefines what's possible, because we don't bother to try what's utterly ridiculous. But once we know for a fact that it's possible, all of a sudden it changes where your efforts go, and you solve problems that previously could never be solved.
Yeah, there are a lot of, like, yeah, that's a great example, because there are a lot of them. Like, it was Roger Bannister in the 4-minute mile. There was like the bench press, which was something like the 600, like the 8, I forget the bench press record. The bench press, and once Roger Bannister broke that record, like, year, just tons of people were doing it. The bench press was the same thing, and it's become, you did not spend the effort towards this direction because you did not know that it would be fruitful. Once you know, oh, this can be done, so instead of spending 8 hours, I'll spend 20 hours or X, you know. And that's if you think about that thought experiment, like, what would you do if you went back in time? You know, if you went back to 1950, you know, what would you might not be able to describe enough of how to build certain things. But if you're like, well, I know batteries, what do they call them? Lithium ion. So maybe there's something to lithium, you know, other kinds of things.
What's funny is I've thought about this. I've thought about, like, if going back to various periods in history and not knowing any of the technical details, just knowing what's possible, could you form a startup that invested technology, you know, with a vague sense of, like, okay, it's 1950. I know, like, transistors come out in the next 20 years or so. So let's start with that. And then 10 years later, you're like, okay, and I know certain things are possible if we interconnect these computers and create a protocol, IP, internet protocol. I remember packets were a thing. Let's have people design, you know, discrete, you know, segments of information and so on.
So I'm just looking up, bench press records are kind of fascinating, because you had, prior to the 20th century, nobody did over, there was no record of anybody doing over 400 pounds, okay? So the highest record, even up until, what is it, like 1916, the record was 363 pounds. Now my brother's a power lifter, my brother's done the police Olympics and all that, he's done like 425. And so, you know, my brother teleported back in time 100 years ago would have been the strongest man in the world. And my brother, as a powerlifter, he's a good one, but he's not Olympic.
Well, and I guess that's the thing, is we don't get a sense nowadays with all of our fortified with vitamins and minerals cereals or whatever. Like, we all enjoy the benefits of a super fortified existence from birth, you know, built on strong genetic stuff.
And one of the things that helped break the record is a thing called the bench shirt, which forces your arms forward. And the record now, the bench press, the total bench press record at this point is over 1,000 pounds.
Shut up.
Okay. Without a bench press shirt, it's 716 pounds, but that's still double what it was in the 19th century.
That's insane.
So that's a little bit of a rat hole there for you. Sorry. But, you know, but yeah, these things. So the alien signal, it certainly changes what we – I mean, if it's a simple basic signal, we would certainly be looking at that and trying to signal process to understand what do they know that we don't know. You know, are they – if it's just a signal and we don't – if we found out tomorrow warp drive was a reality.
Yeah.
We would be wanting to spend billions of dollars trying to develop that.
You know what? It seems like, and let's think real quick, if you are an alien civilization that's unfathomably advanced and you have all these gifts or whatever, these secrets, it seems like before you gave information on how to travel faster than light or light or warp drive or whatever, or propulsion, it's like it seems like you would want to hold off on that information and instead give the secret to, I don't know, evenly distributed free energy for everyone. Or it's like it seems like you would want to give the gifts that would build the kind of civilization you would want coming out of its own home system in order to come meet you, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that the things that we treat kind of the most mundanely are things that are most important. You know, I sent you a link the other day, which I was doing research on something, and I came across this, and it was basically a proposal. It was a proposal for a hypertext markup, and what it was the original proposal for what became the World Wide Web. And, you know, it was this idea of this, hey, we thought it'd be useful if you could put a bunch of documents here and this and have a standardized way of looking at things. And this was an internal document at CERN, which is the European Super Collider. It was Tim Berners-Lee, who, as many of you know, is one of the founders of that. He was the kind of guy behind that, writing this on a Next Step operating system, by the way, invented by Mr. Steve Jobs and company. But point is, as you read this thing and you go, you're like, yeah, this could be really useful. And we had no idea how useful the simple idea was of how to a simple way to organize information has changed our world so much in 20 years that trying to describe the world of 2014 to somebody in 1994, pre-Mosaic, Netscape, Navigator, whatever, and to say, guess where we're going to be 20 years from now?
Yeah, and I get, but like to your point, Brian, it's like, yeah, and that was filled with going to work and, you know, worrying about bills and everything that you would do before that. But it's the new possibilities that I guess like you look back and be like, oh, wow, like we've evolved a lot. Like this is really like kind of not the same world we used to live in, and yet it is at the same time.
Well, and that's the funny part. That's what makes me think of, we've talked about how much we enjoy Peter F. Hamilton's science fiction universes because he takes these mind-blowing, cultural, shifting technologies and sort of, dials them up, for our amazement, and then immediately drops them to talk about how much, how hot this chick is and how great she looks naked and how sexy the dance was, and then also how amazing the fighting and killing was. Like the song kind of doesn't change, only the trappings.
Well, yeah. But it does, right? Like it is very different. It is fundamentally different, but like it's like the stages keep getting changed, and yet we are the same actors, right?
I look at it like kind of like money, and the idea that you look at like if I was rich or if I was this, then I would solve all these problems, but then it invents a whole new level of problems for you. And technology is the same way. And granted, you would much rather have the ability to have money to solve your problems. And technology has radically improved our life tremendously. But now we deal with the problem of excess. You know, our biggest problem with our poor is obesity. And your biggest problem is how we fulfill our leisure time. You know, we can develop the time to get addictions and to develop ourselves into things that we shouldn't. And the future is just going to be the future is not a bigger version of the present, but the citizens are.
I mean, certainly there's echoes of the same kind of problems over and over and over again, and I assume that we'll continue to see them moving forward. But, the only time you don't have any problems is when you're dead. All you can do is trade up for a more interesting set of problems, and I think we're trading up for some very interesting problems.
And I would say that, too, the thing, too, is that it's now – that if you go from problems as the individual had no ability to solve to where your empowerment is tremendously much greater than it ever was. You know, if you lived in the middle of an area that was prone to droughts and you got a drought, you didn't have options unless you could pick up your family and move away. Here we get problems, but we get problems that are more about problems of convenience. And that's what I love about I'd rather live in a world where choice, you know, is dominant, and that's progressively the case that we're moving towards.
So. Yeah. I choose you guys as my podcast host.
Speaking of choices, why don't we jump into some picks right now?
Yeah. Are we all going to pick the same thing? I feel like this is one of those.
You pick I'll pick something else.
House of Cards. Let's talk about it.
I was going to pick that.
Okay. It's on Netflix. It's amazing. It's the best thing ever. I really don't know what more to say about it than, like, it is incredibly well made, and storytelling wise is just a achievement that we root for this cold sociopath, you know, in a way that reminds me of The Sopranos at its best.
My ears are burning.
Kind of without those elements, like it's without like the wishing that he, you know, that the liking Tony Soprano as at least a sympathetic family guy or somebody who is suffering from anxieties himself. There is a distance to the Underwood character that is kind of amazing, but like you just want to see what he does next, and you are rooting for him to succeed as opposed to the agents of truth and justice to bring him to his knees. And it's just, I love it. I love the show. It's so good. I'm only 4 episodes in, but it's a delight.
So, you know, I read Difficult Men, which was about the...
I'm reading that or hearing that now.
How far along are you? Are you enjoying it?
I'm only in, basically the first, like, 30 minutes or whatever, but... It's interesting. I very much like it as a companion to something that I mentioned here on the show before, but The Revolution was televised by Alan Sepinwall, whereas Alan Sepinwall kind of did a very similar book covering a lot of those same shows from a critic's perspective. Difficult Men is more of a reporter's perspective of kind of getting the inside of how the shows were made as opposed to the art that they made.
Well, and one of the things that he talks about in Difficult Men is that in many ways, you know, this 13 or 12 episode structure is kind of like perfect. It feels about the size of a novel, and it's a rare and unique form of art in that you have a showrunner who has a vision, and you have all these little sub writers writing individual chapters for this mega novel that he's putting together. And one of the points that came up along the way was that weirdly the hour-long structure for these television shows kind of puts it on par each individual episode with a movie, because you picture a movie is about 2 hours long. Every single movie you have to do about an hour of setup to really get to the point. You know, you have to establish the characters, you have to set the background, you build the world. In a television show, you know the world, you know the characters, so it's just like the 1 hour that you care about for what's happening in this event is all in there right at the beginning. And that's something that I think House of Cards does extremely well.
So there we go. House of Cards on Netflix. Watch it or don't.
Brian?
I'm going to recommend a different show. And it's not House of Cards. But in fact, it's on traditional television. If you have a cable box, I suggest that you tune it to A&E to watch Don't Trust Andrew Maine every Monday night. You say we got 2 more hour long episode or blocks coming up?
We've got an hour block tomorrow, then a half hour the week after.
However, once you're done watching those, I'd say, why don't you tune in to National Geographic on February 27th at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific, 8 p.m. Central, to check out 2 episodes of a little show I did called Hacking the System. It's a whole show about hacking the planet, everything from how criminals break into houses to how you can talk your way out of speeding tickets, from breaking into cars to blowing them up to ways to convert disposable cameras into tasers. This has been
awesome. Where was the show when I was 12 years old?
it's been an amazing 18-month journey, and it's so we were talking about just before we went live. It's like when you work in the entertainment field, you hear so many stories about so many great ideas that just for whatever reason don't make it to air. The fact that this thing from beginning to end has thrived and survived, I couldn't be prouder. And of course, if the show does well, then, you know, hopefully Nat Geo will order a billion more episodes. And I certainly would love if you guys could support it and maybe tweet out some hashtags, hashtag hacking the system, or thank Nat Geo channel. Nat Geo channel, if you want to show your enthusiasm for the show. I think you guys are going to like it. I certainly do.
When does it air?
The 27th. February 27th, Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific.
I am stoked. I just sound so awesome, Brian. I'm just so the idea of that, all the stuff down there sounds great, and having you talk about the stuff I love, because I know I love your love for that.
Awesome,
I have.
Also, let me just go ahead and read for you guys a text message I got from my mom last night.
Uh-oh.
Gloria Young texted me, "So both of your closest business partners now have a TV show. Interesting trend."
I like it, man.
Gloria Young, go ahead and just tapping her feet. That's nice. Your friends are getting TV shows. It's good. It's good for them. One of these things is not like the other.
Justin, I could put you on the phone with my mom and pretend.
It's a fair point.
See, I'd like to think that it's a vote of confidence, like where it's like, well, apparently that's the end thing and it's happening to everyone, so get ready.
In all seriousness, my mom is very, very supportive and she was very excited, and it was just the way that was written that I found very, very funny.
Yeah. I have two picks.
Okay.
First one, I'm going to make a suggestion. I just watched this the other night. I've talked a lot about, you know, if you play the Weird Things podcast drinking game, Doggerland, which is the land between basically Britain and Europe that is now underwater. But during the last ice age, when a lot of the water was locked up in glaciers and ice caps, et cetera, was above water. You know, it was basically an area the size of Great Britain, essentially there. It's a lost world that is now 300 feet to 100 feet below the waves. We're finding all sorts of fascinating archaeological evidence of what was there. There was a civilization there. There was just, it may have been probably one of the most prime spots in that part of Europe to live. And then in a very quick amount of time, it sank beneath the waves. And this is not some fringe thing. This is a real thing. They're, you know, active archaeology now doing this. There was a British show called Time Team, which does really fun investigations into archaeology, and they did an episode about Doggerland, and it's called The Drowned World, and it's on YouTube. If you type in Time Team and then The Drowned World, you can find this. It's like an hour and a half, and it goes into a lot of the fascinating archaeological evidence and things like that we're finding. Even they go and start doing underwater archaeology right off the coast of the United Kingdom, and Britain, and finding, you know, remnants of fire pits and remnants of what may have been houses and other sort of structures there. And they go walk along the beach and you see these little wooden things, these things sticking out of the ground. And they point out this was a forest 8,000 years ago. And the trees have all been, you know, withered away, but it's a great, it's the best condensation, condensed version of this information I've ever seen.
Awesome.
The Drowned World, The Time Team.
And there, and then, it's all on YouTube.
My other thing is a show that, in the light of like House of Cards and the idea that when you have shows on particularly Netflix and HBO, they can green light things with the idea that like, we don't have to worry about how the first episode does or the second episode does. We can take our time to tell a story, because if we don't get the ratings we want the first episode, we don't care, because the way people consume our content is totally different than broadcast networks. And this means that writers, knowing this, will go into this with a different approach. You know, House of Cards, there's a great little thing that happens at the very end of the first episode, a little kind of moment that, you know, brings you back to all the things, one of the things you loved about the first season, and they could take their time to get to that. They could take their time and get into that. And that means for storytellers, you've got a lot of license to tell the story you want to, not having to be beholden to commercial breaks, not having to be beholden to the idea that if I don't get viewers by that first episode, we're done. And there's a series on HBO that I I've really warmed up to now that it's about midway through, and I have been made aware of fascinating little plot points and details in there that I didn't pay attention to. And now I go, holy cow, there's a whole other thing going on here that I didn't realize. And that is True Detective.
Yeah, I hear huge. Amazing things about True Detective. I know nothing about it. How many seasons is it just starting?
They're going to do I think it's 8 episodes. And they're going to, like, each season will be just a totally different cast, a totally different storyline.
They're taking what has worked so well for American Horror Story and doing it for a gritty detective kind of series. But Matthew McConaughey and who's the other guy?
Woody Harrelson?
Woody Harrelson, yes. They're also producers on the show, right? So who knows whether or not they're going to be on again as different people, but you know, the buzz on it has been that they are going to, you know, the next season will be a totally different story, and it's worked really, really well to have A-list actors that who knows who they'll be able to get now that the show is a hit, you know.
So this is what sort of made me get back into it. I think it was IO9 or something like this said, hey, there's a reference in there that keeps coming up over and over again, and there's some trippy things in there. And I said, no, all right, let me take a look at this. The story is these detectives, you know, it's told in, you know, back in the 90s, then modern day, as a new group of detectives are going back and revisiting this case and doing interviews with the two principal detectives. And there's a lot of little weird stuff that goes on, not on the surface weird, but if subtle, you look in the background or you pay attention to things that people say or things that come up again. And there's references to a book called The King in Yellow, which was totally, you know, below my radar.
Yeah.
And I read a post which talked about like the significance of how much The King in Yellow comes up. And The King in Yellow was a book, a collection of short stories by Robert Chambers back in 1895. The King in Yellow involved, one of the things was it kept reoccurring in some of the stories was this play that if somebody read the entire play would go into madness. And The King in Yellow was very influential. It was this kind of, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, one of the most amazing writers ever, influenced a lot of people, but it was hard to see the evidence of that until maybe in the early part of the 20th century. But The King in Yellow was certainly influenced by him to an extent. And he incorporates elements, Chambers incorporates elements in The King in Yellow. It's classified as supernatural horror. H.P. Lovecraft, that's the porn version. H.P. Lovecraft so much loved, you know, some of the elements of The King in Yellow, he actually incorporated elements of it into the Cthulhu mythos.
Oh, wow.
So you have basically, if you read a Lovecraft story, you'll see some things that touch upon there. And so True Detective touches upon this. And so this idea that there's elements of this thing that touches into Cthulhu mythos is involved in there is awesome.
That's rad. So I know you were fairly impatient with the first couple episodes when we talked about it on the phone, but it's has it picked up? Like why have you changed your opinion of it?
I would say the thing that changed my opinion of it was that it got into elements of it, like finding out that there's this deeper mythos going on there was certainly made me go, okay, there's another layer there that goes in there. And then I watched the episode 4. There's a sequence there, which I loved, which was very much like, you know, there's a scene that goes on for like, it's an action sequence. It's like 10 minutes long. It's like an Alfonso Cuarón one. And it looks like it was shot all in real time. If you look, you can say, okay, edit here, but this whole like 10-minute thing that takes place, it's cool. And my biggest reservations is of the two characters. McConaughey's character is very, very engaging, and Harrelson's character is a guy that just is not likable, and it was hard to get into it because of the fact that he just was not as likable as that. But getting to this, I'm at the point now midway through where I want to see it to its conclusion.
Rad. So True Detective on HBO.
And yeah, dude, everybody's talking about it. I'm that's excited thing, like, to experience it.
I was ready to give up on it. Read a post, and it doesn't solve the fact that those first couple episodes for me just moved so slowly. And it may be a thing that I'll go watch it again and go, oh my God, there's more going on than I realized. And there was stuff going on, but it was just the pacing was just that. But I'm episode 4 and looking forward to 5, which is on tonight, and see where it goes.
Hell yeah.
Right on.
All right, gentlemen. It's been weird.